Good evening and welcome to City Visions. I'm your host, Lauren Meltzer. Tonight, our topic is dogs and the people they live with. San Francisco, a city of 805,000 people, is the second most densely populated large city in the U.S. after New York City. According to the San Francisco Animal Care and Control, about a fourth to one-third of all San Francisco households have at least one dog for an estimated population of 120,000 to 140,000 dogs living in the city. That's more dogs than the 112,000 estimate of city children. Why is there such a high number of dogs? What is the role of socialization, community, and culture in sustaining and managing healthy human-pet relationships in the Bay Area? And what breeds of dogs and people are best suited to the San Francisco urban environment? Is it okay to buy a dog? Joining me in the studio tonight to talk about these issues and more are Dr. Jennifer Scarlett, co-president of the San Francisco SPCA, a veterinarian with more than 20 years of experience in both nonprofit and for-profit veterinary medicine. She has created a number of visionary programs, including Community Cares, a vaccine outreach program, and FOSPICE, a shelter program that uses foster homes to care for the most medically challenged shelter animals. Welcome, Scarlett.
Thank you.
And we also have in studio Allison Smith, co-owner and director of training and behavior of the Metro Dog Daycare, which is a daycare, boarding, and training center in the Richmond. And her experience is helping Bay Area families understand their canine friends, combining with knowledge gained from the myriad of dogs who have passed through her life with insights of trainers, behaviorists, ethologists, and researchers whom she's studied. So welcome, Allison.
Thank you.
And of course, we'll be taking calls from you. We want to hear your thoughts and opinions, so give us a call at 415-841-4134 or email us at feedback@cityvisionsradio.com. So, you know, I want to start out with you, Allison, and I actually would like to talk about the sociology of dogs. And when I say that, what I mean is we have 120,000 to 140,000 dogs living in the city. Why do you think there's so many dogs?
There is a really interesting connection between people and dogs and the way that dogs have moved into our lives. A quick history would be that they were working, they performed tasks that were of use to people. But really, in the last 100 years, their job is being pets. Their job is being companions, providing comfort and stimulation for their humans.
And has that always been the case? Since they started providing that, like as kind of a pet, human companion, has there always been so many dogs in San Francisco, or is that kind of a new thing here in the city?
I think that people have grown more comfortable having pets in urban areas. I hear less and less the myth that you need to be in the country to have a dog. So I think that's true. I think people are more comfortable now owning dogs in the city, and there are more resources. There's more social acceptance around it, so people do it more.
Okay.
If I can just piggyback on that, you know, it's about pet ownership, but if you look at other countries and urban environments, that, you know, for example, in Romania and Bucharest, there's estimated to be 250,000 dogs who aren't pets, street dogs. So this association between humans and dogs is tight, whether or not we accept them into our homes and into our bedrooms and feed them every day, or if they're just around us. So we see dense dog populations in other urban areas that don't necessarily have the same sort of level of of status that we have here in San Francisco or in the United States.
Yeah, you know, that's an interesting point, Scarlett. So in terms of the number that I quoted earlier in the show, those are dogs that live with families. So do you have any sense for how many stray dogs there are in the city?
There are very few. I mean, as a listener, just think about the number of times you've seen a stray dog or stray dogs running in packs. Whereas if you go to many other countries, especially countries that are just developing, you know, one of the things that people would come back from Mexico City or from other countries and say, it was heart-wrenching to see the packs of dogs. So we're pretty lucky in San Francisco. The number of stray dogs, actually living stray and feral, is extremely low.
Does San Francisco, do you think the people in San Francisco have more heart when it comes to dogs than in other cities? Well, first in the United States.
Well, I think the San Franciscos just have more heart, period. So we do have a, we're pretty lucky. You know, we have access to some gorgeous areas, and it is a local community that accepts diversity and accepts having animals as companions.
Great. And in terms of the culture of, you know, dog culture here in the city, what kinds of dogs, I guess we'll go back to you, Allison, what kinds of dogs are living here in San Francisco?
Well, all kinds of dogs.
I mean, there's all kinds of dogs, but I mean, right. Are there certain kinds that people tend to choose when they're, you know, here as San Francisco?
I see a lot of, you know, mixed breed dogs. Rescuing is also something that is very popular. People of all economic brackets and backgrounds are rescuing dogs. And so, you know, the mixed breed and the shelter population is comprised largely of what is out there running loose, essentially. So you get a lot of mixed breed dogs.
In terms of the SPCA, do you tend to see only the mixed breed, or do you see the full breed too?
Well, nationally, about 25% of dogs that enter a shelter are purebreds.
Okay.
We see a lot of sort of bully breeds, pit bull mixes, and we also see a tremendous number of chihuahuas due to a lot of backyard breeding and the recent popularity with movies and various.
What's a backyard breeding? That's really...
Well, we have sort of sections of the city that have a couple of intact or not spayed or neutered chihuahuas and, you know, are selling them on a small scale. So not, we don't have puppy mills in San Francisco, but we have a lot of folks who have a male and a female, or their neighbor has a male or the opposite gender, and they do some small scale breeding.
And when you say, is it to make money, or is it just...
I don't know. We're actually looking into doing a little research to find out more about this, because we're seeing this constant influx of chihuahuas into the shelter. But my hunch would be that it's a way to make a little bit of money.
What do you think the major issues are, Scarlett, when it comes to dogs in the city these days?
Major, you mean negative issues?
Either. Just the things that, you know, I mean, you both have been working with dogs for a long time. 2011, what are the major issues?
Yeah. For us as a shelter, what we see is some very strong socioeconomic patterns to who winds up in the shelter and what happens to them once they get into the shelter. And so we're pretty lucky in San Francisco. There is this incredible safety net of trainers that can offer training advice, and for rescues that offer a safety net for animals, dogs and cats. But in certain segments of the city, they don't have access. And so we see under-socialization, and then we see housing situations where they're not allowed to have pets, or their landlord now kicks them out. And now we have an unsocialized bully breed or chihuahua in the shelter. And that's really hard to save.
Interesting. Is there anything that you would add to that, Allison, in terms of?
Yeah. Well, issues? I think truly, people getting pets and then discovering that they can't manage what they've taken on. I see a lot of people turn their lives inside out trying to, and whether it's destruction or barking, even where people are not renting, homeowner issues, once your neighbors decide that they don't like your barking dog, life gets very uncomfortable very quickly. So, you know, I encounter homeowners who are, you know, constantly under threat by their neighbors for their dog's behavior, even if it's not really bad. But once somebody's sensitized, it becomes a problem.
And what happens to these dogs who normally, like, is it, is it, does, do people get to keep their dogs, or do they have to change the behavior to keep their dogs, or how does it normally?
Yeah, generally what I see is a lot of stress in the households. I mean, in those households, they will, you know, do
muzzles.
All. Hopefully not. but, you know, they'll try accommodating. I'll come in and look at how their house is set up and make suggestions about where they could keep their dogs to make them less stressed so that they're not barking as much, and hook them up with dog walkers and so forth to take care of those problems.
Wait, so looping back to the socioeconomic patterns, I'm guessing that you were talking about the socialized dog and the under-socialized dog. So can you tell us a little bit more about that, Scarlett, in terms of what a socialized dog would look like and what an under-socialized dog would look like?
And you'll see under-socialized dogs all over town. It's not, but we see it more in certain breeds and in certain areas. But so a socialized dog is a dog that's able to walk loosely on a leash and pass other dogs and people without lunging, snarling, or also retracting in fear. That can be, basically, there's a test called a good citizen canine test. And what they're testing for is this dog socialized well enough? And socialization, by the way, that window for dogs is pretty small. So between the ages of about 4 to 6 weeks to about 16 weeks is when a dog really takes in the world. And at that point, they need to hear sirens, and they need to meet a lot of people, and they need to socialize with dogs. If they miss that window, then it's more difficult to have them. They become overwhelmed easily, and it becomes very difficult to live in a crowded urban environment with that dog without a substantial amount of work. And so we see it all over the place. And if you've ever been walking down the street and you see two dogs go to meet each other and one just loses it, that may be a case of that dog having not been socialized well with other dogs.
And are most people that adopt dogs through shelters, are they getting dogs that have been socialized or not socialized, or is it, you can't really make a generalization?
Well, we try. You know, they say there's one thing about behavior that you can always predict, and that is that it changes. But one of the things that we do in the shelter environment is we look at dog-to-dog interactions and dog-to-people interactions and work with those dogs that need help, and then try to place people based on their experiences with dogs with the right dog. So if you have sort of that Cadillac dog that's going to get along with everybody and it's a new dog owner with a child, then that's going to be more appropriate than the high-energy lab that's going to be much more difficult to control. So we try to make that match based on people's experience and their needs and what the dog has to offer.
Okay. And going back to Allison Smith, so you work with training and behavior mm-hmm. of dogs. So in, you know, the window that Scarlett was talking about, I mean, is that similar to the human brain, that there's just like this small period when the human brain, children can learn new things and then right. It's kind of fixed? Is it similar?
Well, the interesting thing is that children socialize until they're 8 years old.
Oh.
So that's the equivalent number. So if you can think about how many things somebody is exposed to before they're 8 years old versus what you could do with a dog before they're 16 weeks old, and people don't generally get dogs until they are 7, 8 weeks old. We hope that they get to stay with their mothers that long. And so you now have 8 weeks to get your dog exposed to everything that they're going to be exposed to in your everyday life, and what's important for them. I get a lot of people coming in who want to use daycares to socialize their 4-year-old chihuahuas, actually. and that is, really explaining to people that it's not something that you can apply later. You can help a dog be better with things, but under stress, that dog is fundamentally not socialized.
So. And just to make it a little bit tougher, this is also the most sensitive time for them immunologically. So they're going through their vaccine series, and they're not protected against a couple of diseases which are prevalent, mainly parvovirus. So you're not supposed to take them out to a lot of places because they may come down with the disease because they haven't finished their vaccine. But lo and behold, you're also supposed to introduce them right. to all the things that they're going to be seeing through the rest of their life. So it's a very delicate balance.
Now, can dogs which have been socialized, can they learn bad habits from
Oh, yeah.
Socialized dogs?
I have one at home. I should have brought her. I could have
my example. We have as a third guest.
I definitely developed bad habits after I was 8 years old. So.
Okay, so similarly.
At least dogs don't smoke.
Yeah, exactly. So, yeah, absolutely. Dogs learn all kinds of habits, anything that they do repeatedly and get something they want. So socialization has nothing to do with getting into the garbage or chasing the cat or, pulling on leash. It has nothing to do with any of those things. Those are just behaviors.
Are there, in terms of exercise, how much does that play into, you know, being a socialized, well-adjusted, happy dog, Alice?
Well-adjusted? Absolutely. Exercise, mental stimulation, and consistency are the hallmarks of a sane dog.
Okay. And then how does that, would you call that nurture as opposed to nature, which is the actually traits that people breed for?
It is management over genetics. Nature and nurture are always there together. Mm-hmm. They're never separate.
So is it, how common are the, you know, the designer dogs these days? Do people, is this a common thing in the city or mutt kind of more the...
Where do you draw the line on designer dogs?
I don't know. I'll ask you. Where do you draw the line? Tell us about this. We do see it more
Scarlet. And more. Yeah, and... you know, some of it was by intent to try to get that hybrid vigor. The thought is if you take two different breeds, that you sort of lessen the chance you're going to get the sort of negative effects of a highly bred, purebred. What we see now more and more is kind of laziness through puppy mills. So they'll make up a breed like a Malty Poo, Hava Poo, or whatever. And,
right.
And you just wonder was that they didn't know what was going on. I mean, they're super cute. They're great dogs. But I do question whether or not those are responsible breeders really thinking about coming up with a breed that fits a certain niche, or if it's just sloppiness and online purchasing driving those new breeds mixes.
Okay. What I do see a lot are, you have a lot of doodles of various kinds, and, you know, the original intent with the Labradoodle was actually to make a great pet dog that was healthy and temperamentally really solid and hypoallergenic. So everything everybody ever wanted. And then you have a lot of people who just breed a lab and a poodle together, and what you get is really scary.
Oh no, what happens?
It's wire-haired, gigantic, and generally really hyperactive.
So you get the worst of both breeds. In a way.
Yeah, exactly. It takes a lot.
Do they call it a Labradoodle?
They do. Labradoodles are very expensive, and so certainly people are looking at how much someone is willing to pay. Then they make a sort of fake Labradoodle and charge half as much.
What is the difference between a real and a fake Labradoodle?
Am I going to get in trouble here?
I think, being a responsible breeder is they're going to be thinking about the lines, and they're going to be looking and following up on their dogs versus an irresponsible breeder breeding for an opportunity. Labradoodles are popular, so therefore I'm going to just put this out there. And so we do see this, especially in this mix, this variation of really great dogs and really hyper dogs. And I think it's a fairly new mix, and I think it's probably a combination of those two breeds as well as responsible breeders and probably irresponsible breeders out there.
If you're just tuning in, this is City Visions. Tonight we're discussing dog culture, behavior, and community here in San Francisco. My guests are Dr. Jennifer Scarlett, the veterinarian and co-president of the San Francisco SPCA, and Allison Smith, co-owner and director of behavior at Metro Dog, a daycare and training facility in the East Bay. If you'd like to join us, here's the number, 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. Or join us by emailing us at feedback@cityvisionsradio.com. Are you a dog owner or are you not a dog owner? We want to hear from you both. We'd like to know what kind of concerns or questions you have here living in the city with a dog. So call us at, again, 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. Or email us at feedback@cityvisionsradio.com. So in terms of, so we've talked a little bit about, I guess, genetics or breeding and responsibility. Let's talk a little bit about designer dogs. I mean, we talked a little bit about designer dogs, but what is that a kind of dog for the rich then? I mean, is this where economics kind of takes or no?
We see quote unquote designer dogs brought into the shelter all the time, and in our, you know, some of our vaccine clinic work and in other areas, we see people of all different walks of life with quote unquote designer breeds. They're readily accessible online. A lot of people are seemingly buying dogs online, and the problem with that is you never quite know what you're supporting. And so, you know, going back to that have a poodle malty snoozle, it's not really a breed. It more than likely it's coming from a facility that has multiple breeds, and that's what's just coming out.
Right. And also also speaks to the education of that dog owner. That is, that person is getting their information from those sources also. So everything they know about dogs comes from the internet, and, you know, they're not necessarily getting good information about what they should or shouldn't be doing.
Well, it's a ridiculous term anyway. I mean, breeds have been bred for years and years and years for specific tasks, and now to call it a designer breed because you just had two different breeds that got together really flies in the face of what good breeders have been doing for hundreds of years.
But in terms of the economics, I mean, do you find that you really see certain, you know, the better dogs go to the people with more money than that can afford it, or
better dogs? I mean, they're all great.
They're all great. Listen to me. Am I a dog owner? No. I'm putting that in quotation marks, though. Better dogs. When I say that, I mean, I'm assuming that,
you know,
people think they're buying designer dogs for a reason, right?
Well, there's not much data out there where I can say, yes, you know, 70% of people from this economic range buy purebreds versus so-and-so. You know, there's just that information just isn't there.
Yeah, I think it really goes back more to what people know about dogs rather than economics. So educated people looking for dogs, when I have people come to me and say, I'm looking for a great family pet, I want this breed, and I'll walk them through, you know, pick a breeder, go look at every dog on the street, find a dog that looks like the one you want, that acts like the one you want, ask them where they got it. That breeder should run you through the ringer, and it's going to cost you.
But dogs are individuals, and the main thing that ultimately, I mean, some people are really drawn to a phenotype or a look. Most people are drawn to, I want a dog that can run with me. I want a dog that's good with my kids, that lives with my cats. And behavior is so individual. And so you can't predict behavior by breed. And so you can go down to the shelter and you can go to a rescue and you can find a dog that fits what you want in your life. It may not come in the phenotype or the look that you had in mind. So have your heart open and be ready to embrace a really funny-looking chihuahua or something
is,
like that.
That is so important, and that is really my bone that I like to pick.
Well, let me go. We have a couple people on the phone, so let me take first Gordon from San Francisco. Good evening, Gordon.
Oh, hi. How are you doing?
Good. Thanks for calling City Visions.
Oh, thank you for taking my call. My point is brief, and I totally agree with what your guests are saying, that, you know, 99% of dogs are wonderful. It's, in many cases, the owners have no idea what they're getting into. And I just want to urge everybody, before they get a dog, to do some research. And I sure wish that the adoption agencies would make people take a class on the responsibility that a dog, a well-behaved dog, is going to require.
Are you a dog owner?
Well, we've had about 8 dogs in our lives. Right now, we don't have one. Our last dog was put to sleep about a year ago.
Sorry.
And she had really bad hip dysplasia and couldn't walk anymore at all.
Okay. So. And Gordon, from your perspective, what's the biggest surprise as a dog owner?
Oh, just the amount of time it takes. I mean, dogs don't like to be left alone, so people think they can, oh, my dog stays at home by itself, and then I go to work, and then I have a social life, and now my dog, everything's destroyed in my house. I don't know what to do. I mean, the dog is, it's like having a kid, basically.
Yeah. Did you want to add to that? Thank you for calling in, Gordon.
Yeah, thank you, Gordon. I absolutely agree. And but the majority of people don't get their dogs from a shelter. They don't have the chance to speak to an adoption officer, a counselor, or a knowledgeable rescue person. The majority of people get their dogs from friends or family or from online or breeder sources. So when you come into a rescue or to a shelter, you actually get some counseling, and at the SPCA we offer classes for people to follow up with, so much more than what they would get anywhere else.
Do you do you both find that the best way, from your opinion, do you think it's the best way, if you are interested in a dog, is to go to a shelter where you can get more?
Shoot, yeah. Oh. Yes, I think that that's a great place to start. But wherever you get your dog, and I'm not against purebreds. If you're going to get a dog, whatever you do, you can find a dog online, but you have to go drive to that facility and see what you're supporting. Do not buy online.
And see, yeah, and meet the dogs that made that dog. Mm-hmm. Because if you meet the parents, you'll have a pretty good idea of what that dog is going to be like, at least by size and energy level.
If you're just tuning in, this is City Visions. Tonight we're discussing the behavior, dog culture, behavior, and community in San Francisco. Joining me are Dr. Jennifer Scarlett, veterinarian and co-president of the San Francisco SPCA, and Allison Smith, co-owner and director of behavior at MetroDog, a daycare and training facility in the East Bay. You can join us by calling 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134, or emailing us at feedback at cityvisionsradio.com. And this is City Visions. City Visions airs on KALW. And again, tonight we're talking about dogs and their behavior and the culture and the community. So if you are a dog lover, if you are a dog hater, we want to hear from both of you. Again, give us a call at 415-235-5798. Let me go to another caller. We have Kim from San Francisco. Kim, hi, how are you?
Hi, how are you? Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I was wondering if you could expand on the socialization window a little bit, because my experience has been very different. I got my dog when she was 7. I'd never had a dog before. And she was kind of a monster, to be honest. She was jumping people. She was jumping dogs. She was kind of jumping everything. And we went to classes, and I can take her everywhere now.
Well, so your experience then was that what in regards to the socialization window, what did you feel?
Well, basically, she got socialized when she was 7 years old, and she's an angel now.
Okay. Allison, do you want to talk about this? You're laughing.
Yeah. So socialization is a period of time during which an animal, a person, is open to new things, and it becomes part of how they sort of identify themselves and what is normal. You can condition or teach behavior at any age to any dog. So learning to have better manners can be done much later in life. It can be more challenging, and dogs can be truly, truly fearful or uncomfortable with things they haven't been exposed to. But a large number of adult dogs that are coming without that socialization can be trained to tolerate new situations, tolerate people, even be great with it. It's just not as easy.
Okay.
Maybe I misunderstood what you were saying.
Well, the difference would be Let's say your dog was never socialized with other dogs. She might jump on you and be a real knothead in the house because she has poor manners. But outside in the street, she might act incredibly fearfully, recoiling, trying to run away, or just the opposite, fear aggressive, snarling, snapping, lunging. That would indicate that she may not have been well socialized as a puppy. The other thing to remember is that fears can come on any time in life. We see noise phobias come on later in life. So you can have a dog that's well adjusted, but have a traumatic incident later in life. With sirens or with gunshots or fireworks, and that can set off a set of behaviors as well. It doesn't mean that they weren't necessarily socialized to fireworks. They may have been fine, but something really traumatic happened to them.
Thank you so much, Kim.
Thank you.
Again, if you're just tuning in, this is City Visions on 91.7 KALW San Francisco and on the web at KALW.org. And my topic tonight is dog culture and community in San Francisco. My guests are Dr. Jennifer Scarlett, veterinarian and co-president of the San Francisco SPCA, and Allison Smith, co-owner and director of behavior at Metro Dog, a daycare and training facility in the East Bay. You can join us by calling 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134, or emailing us at feedback@cityvisionsradio.com. This is the time. We've got two amazing experts here. If you have questions about living in the city with dogs or having a neighbor who has a dog, give us a call. I'm going to go to the next call. We have Rachel from Oakland. Good evening, Rachel.
Hi, thanks so much for taking my call.
Sure.
So we got a rescue leash. She's really adorable and sweet. And we got some tips from friends and the person who actually rescued her on how to potty train her. We, my husband and I both work all day, unfortunately, and so we were told to buy some pee pads and dip them, if she has an accident, dip them in her little spot and then put the pee pads out. And sometimes she really is on target and it works. And other times she misses both number one and two, excuse the, you know, going into too deep on this on air, but my husband and I are just kind of at a loss. I mean, she's really sweet. She's very friendly. We have two kids, and we actually give her a big space to hang out in during the day.
So you're just, it sounds like you've got a lot of concern about why she's has this behavior, understandably.
So,
Allison.
Yeah, without this turning into a training consult on the air, what in order for dogs to learn to go outside, they need two things. They need to go outside and eliminate there and have that be a positive experience. And they need to be prevented from doing it in the house because anywhere you go, it feels good. It's rewarding. If you're not there and the dog is peeing on the floor, even if it's on a pee pad, they're still practicing eliminating in the house. It's sort of a big leap for a dog to understand, do it on this piece of paper, but not over there.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, thank you, Kim. I mean, thank you, Rachel. I want to actually take another caller with a totally different angle. We have Jamie from San Francisco. Good evening, Jamie. Thank you for calling in.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. First, let me say I'm not a dog owner, and I love dogs. I think they're fabulous. But I'm curious to get your guest's take on people who kind of disregard the health code ordinances about bringing dogs into food service facilities, and kind of conversely also related, people who masquerade their dogs as service dogs. I mean, I speak from experience. I have a dear friend who says her dog has a little jacket and says her dog is a service dog, and she doesn't require a service dog. I personally kind of feel that's insulting to the people who do require service dogs and also the great dogs that do those jobs. So I'm just curious to get your guest's take on that.
Yeah, that's, thank you for calling in with those questions.
Well,
Scarlett.
I agree with you. You know, I'm a dog guardian, and I advocate strongly for all the benefits that dogs bring in our life. And at the beginning of the show, we talked about there's more dogs than children in San Francisco, but that doesn't that doesn't come with a sense of entitlement. And it's important that to live in this crowded world, we need to abide by the laws that are set up for dog ownership, and to have respect for those who are in a place where they dogs are not allowed, in respect for the health codes around picking up after their number twos, to use Rachel's term. And so, you know, it's the tension is getting greater and greater as we become a more crowded spot. And all I can do is beg dog guardians to please be considerate of those who are not comfortable with dogs, and be considerate to those rules that are in place. As far as your friend and the status of their dog, I absolutely can't comment on that because I don't know your friend. But dogs, what I can say is that we do know that many dogs provide a level of comfort for conditions that may not be as obvious as blindness or some other incapacity, that physical incapacity. So there may be something there that we don't know about that dog is really helping her with. And I can only trust that the regulatory agencies are monitoring that closely and giving out those licenses accordingly.
Do you have anything to add to that, Elsa?
I do not. That covered it.
Well, I'm curious. So in other countries like France, dogs can come into restaurants freely. So what's the difference?
Because France is cool. No, and in France, you don't have to wash the eggs either. You just put them out on the counter and sell them. I mean, there's lots of laws and health codes that are very different from culture to culture. There's some cultures where, you know, you're not even supposed to touch a dog. So this is what we've come up for our culture. You know, I think, you know, from a public health, as a veterinary perspective, do I think it's safe to have a dog in an eating establishment? Probably so, but there are other factors that are involved with people's comfort level. And there's lots of, we're lucky to be in San Francisco where there's lots of sidewalks and outdoor areas. So we have lots of options and we can abide by those rules.
Okay. Well, let me go to another caller. We have John from San Francisco. Good evening, John. Thank you for calling in to City Visions this evening. Oh, Esten. Esten.
Oh, hi.
Hi.
I'm on here. Hello.
Hi. Welcome to City Visions.
Yeah. Glad to be here. Thanks for taking my call. I just wanted to share with you my experience with a dog that had major socialization issues. I had worked with German Shepherds a great deal, and I want to put a plug in for working with rescue groups because you can get any phenotype or purebred dog through a rescue group, and it's a good way to go in the sense that they tend to vet the dogs and are much more careful about matching the individual dog to the person, and they often have an unconditional return policy if it doesn't work out. So I think that's a really good way to go rather than going through a breeder or obviously internet. But my experience was that I had done a lot of work with German Shepherds, in particular working in avalanche rescue work as a ski patrolman back in the Rockies, and I came out here and I'd had a lot of great shepherds and decided it was my time to give something back to them. And there was a dog through German Shepherd Rescue of Northern California that had been used as fighting dog bait out in Stockton at 5 months of age. She had been found tied up to a bench in the Stockton Park with duct tape still around her nose and a bunch of lacerations on her. And then because of her behavioral issues, had been sort of kenneled for a while, which didn't help the issue. But took her initially. I thought I was just going to foster her, and then I realized after about 24 hours that if I didn't work it out with her, that she wasn't going to make it. And it took me about 2 years, and it was an awful lot of work, but finally got her around to being a very, very good dog with other dogs, and she's a phenomenally good dog now. She's about 8 now.
Esten, did you have a specific question, or did you want to just share?
No, I just wanted to share, and I wanted to put in a plug for rescue groups as far as if you really are intent on a particular type of dog, you can always find a rescue group that specializes in that type of dog, and that's a great way to go get them.
That's a great plug. That's a great plug, Esten, and it kind of brings me to, I guess, a question for you, Scarlett, in terms of, is this common that you would see, or actually you, Allison, too, I mean, that you could, you know, people, I think, sometimes get scared about rescue animals because of their past, like the, you know, hardship they've had. So, but is it typical that you can really change, someone that's had a really bad past and make him into a happy, socialized dog, gentle dog?
I think the key thing in what he said is it's a lot of work. So it's appropriate for somebody who wants to take that on. I encounter lots of people who have great big hearts and try to take it on, but then they they end up really, everybody in their family ends up suffering, the dog, them, mm-hmm. their kids, whatever, whoever else is in the picture, because it is a lot of work, depending on what issues you're talking about with that dog.
But not all rescue dogs are under-socialized. They're there for other reasons, because of landlord or housing issues, and they're perfectly lovely dogs. So I just want to move away from that all rescue dogs
Absolutely.
Are troubled and take a lot of work.
No,
some
that's
of them
a
are.
Good point.
Yeah.
So it's been said that pet abandonment is a community issue. Can you explain that? Why it becomes a community issue?
Well, one is it's we have a public service that we pay for. Our taxes go to pay for animal care and control that has to take up the slack when people fail their animals. And in sheltering, we look at, you know, a shelter is a safe haven, and we're really fortunate in San Francisco that it is truly that. Healthy, adoptable animals will find a home. But it takes a lot of work to get there. So it's a community issue because, one, it's we're paying for it with our taxes. We're also paying for it emotionally. And when we look at what causes pet abandonment, not being spayed and neutered is the number one reason. Not having any training is another reason, and not being able to afford medical care, which is why, you know, we have a hospital that all the profits go to charity care, and we actually want to get to a place where abandonment, for those reasons, it becomes obsolete, and it's really those catastrophic life events that an animal winds up in the shelter, not routine.
How long can a dog stay confined before there's real effects?
Well, it depends about what you talk about with confined. You know, we have kennels and we have tons of volunteers that take them out, and it's really individual. You know, we try to mimic a house environment for our dogs at the Maddie's Adoption Center, but there are some dogs that it's too stressful for them, that they really need to be in a foster home. So it's very individual. A laid-back dog can do fine for months before they find a home. Another dog that's quite fearful, that is overstimulated in a shelter environment, really needs to get to a foster soon.
So a recent article said that the San Francisco Animal Care and Control is asking people to hold off giving their unwanted dogs because of lack of space at their shelters. Is this the case right now?
The San Francisco Animal Care and Control is doing something that that many shelters don't have the opportunity to do, and that is they're really trying to stretch their life-saving capacity. So we do see an increase in the number of dogs that are being given up for financial reasons currently, but it pales in comparison to what's happening in Central Valley and the rest of the United States. I applaud Animal Care and Control for trying to make some extra time for those dogs that need additional help, that need to go into foster, and that's what they're trying to do. So there's an increase in the dogs that are coming in. It's not huge, but given the population that we have and the time that they spend in the shelter, it has a bigger effect.
So what factors such as economy or a hit movie can affect the overcrowding, Allison?
Oh, that's huge. And I think it really speaks to San Francisco that it's got such great resources for people giving up their dogs when they need to, because most rescue organizations and shelters are so taxed by these influxes. Absolutely, 1001 Dalmatians has filled the world with Dalmatians, and, you know, the Taco Bell Chihuahua and so forth. It is, oh, and the Portuguese water dogs.
Are those gentle dogs? I look at them sometimes and they look like a labradoodle to me in some ways. Are they, you're laughing again, see? You guys...
They are a serious working dog. They are not good for first-time dog owners.
Okay.
They have a lot of energy. They're very intense dogs.
All right. Scarlett, tell us about the Chihuahua airlifts.
Well, that's done through Animal Care and Control. They have a connection with a shelter in New York, which apparently is low on Chihuahuas. So they've been airlifting some of the Chihuahuas there. Because what we know in shelters is that it's a mix of, you know, to be a successful shelter, you have to have a variety of dogs available so that people are coming to you and adopting and not going online to buy. And so, the transfer of dogs across the country has become quite popular so that we can kind of balance out. If New Yorkers want Chihuahuas, we have Chihuahuas.
If you're just tuning in, this is City Visions. Tonight we're discussing dog culture, behavior, and community in San Francisco and the Bay Area. Joining me tonight are Dr. Jennifer Scarlett, veterinarian and co-president of the San Francisco SPCA, and Allison Smith, co-owner and director of behavior at MetroDog, daycare and training facility in the East Bay. If you'd like to join us, the number is 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. Or join us by emailing us at feedback@cityvisionsradio.com. I want to go to Bob. We have a caller, Bob, from Palo Alto. Good evening, Bob.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I have a question. I've read in the papers that there have been some experiments recently trying to determine whether animals have conscience, particularly in terms of dolphins and porpoises, and chimpanzees, if I remember correctly. I'm wondering, and of course this is the idea that animals can think in ways that are at least emulate a little bit like humans do. Has any of the work that the panelists know about work done with dogs in this area?
I know that
great
there,
question, Bob.
Yeah, there are. There is some work on these. On these topics, people are always it's a very complicated thing to ascertain, particularly with dogs because they are so accustomed to living and interacting with humans that it's hard to tell how much we're influencing what they do as opposed to them just doing it on their own.
And it's so hard, you know, there's more and more interesting sort of tests to try to figure out their cognitive abilities and how they look at their own image and recognize their image or have a sense of self. So I don't have a specific answer for you. I don't think anybody does. It's
no.
A great question. But I do have a recommendation for you. If you want to watch an amazing documentary, watch Dogs Decoded. It was put on by PBS a few years ago. And there's some things in there that will really get you scratching your head and wondering about how far or how much dogs really know about humans and how much we know about dogs.
Dogs know a lot about humans.
Yeah. I mean, do you think that people that really believe that their dogs know a lot about them and they have a kind of relationship, do you think that's projection or do you think that really is, they really probably have that kind of relationship?
No, it's real. And that's, you know, that's why people are so passionate about their dogs is that connection is absolutely real. And dogs have an uncanny ability to read our emotions and to react to them. And it's our expressions and it's our body language and they probably know more about us. They're like our hairdresser, except they don't talk about it.
Let me take an email from Rorikio. He wants to know, should we consider a sustainable canine caring capacity and limit the number of dogs in San Francisco? Are there a limited number of licenses issued?
Well, right now, only about 10 to 12% of people register their dogs through animal care and control. So if you have a dog and it's not registered, please do because you're supporting your local animal care and control. It's a really interesting question. In many populations, it's the nesting ability is usually the limiting factor. And in San Francisco, housing, nesting is a very big issue. So I don't know. I would wonder how you would work that out. I would say overall, no. I think that what will happen is pressure over housing will naturally limit the number of dogs that we have in the city.
Do you think for any other reason there's any reason to have a limit except for?
Well, they've been with us for a very long time. They're absolutely compatible with our existence and urban and as well as farm areas. And as long as we're good dog guardians, we're cleaning up after them, we're being thoughtful about their training, I don't see a reason necessarily to limit.
Okay, we have another comment from John in San Francisco, and he wants to talk a little bit about the expense of dogs in the city. So maybe, Allison, maybe you can talk about that.
Well, I mean, there's lots of different ways in which dogs live with people, even here. People have dogs in their families at very low costs, and people have elaborate setups, and I have clients who have cars for their dogs.
I think there's quite a range. Especially with access to low-cost veterinary care, it's possible for people who are lower income to really keep a dog well.
For how, what are we talking about in terms of costs? I mean, what's the minimum that if someone was out there thinking to themselves, I would like to get a dog, but I am concerned about the cost. What are we talking about?
You're talking about basic veterinary care, annual visits to the vet. So I have absolutely no idea what that costs.
Okay.
Well, Americans spend about... overall, Americans spend a tremendous amount of money, and it does vary on the age of the dog. What we recommend for people, we actually offer insurance because it's those unexpected veterinary bills that that are usually the biggest hit and why people wind up leaving their dogs. So dog food varies. You can buy a dog 5-pound bag of dog food for $6, or you can buy one for $21. So
you get the raw food diet,
right? So there's a lot of variation on what you decide to do as a dog guardian. But then it's those veterinary bills. But you can go with insurance to try to help. Consumer Reports just came out and said that you're better off just putting some money aside. So I recommend that people put $500 a year away for routine veterinary visits, sort of those unexpected costs. If you can put money away every month to save up for those things that are truly unexpected.
And what about dog walkers? How much are dog walkers?
They're priceless.
I think it's pretty average across the Bay Area. It's about $25 a walk.
$25 a walk. So that can really add up.
It can really add up. So most people use this as ancillary. So they walk their own dogs. And then on really busy days, it's more about getting that dog out in the middle of the day when they have really long days that are longer than the dog can stay inside. Daycare is about the same for people. So daycare works for people who need to leave their dogs for longer periods of time.
Is it healthier for dogs to have a companion? For if you're going to get a dog, to get two dogs as opposed to just one, or are dogs okay?
Depends on the dog.
They're very social creatures, so companionship is, I think, different than having another dog. So that can be a human companion. And if you look at street dogs and in other countries, they have a lot going on. They're meeting other dogs. They're getting into the garbage. They're busy, and so dogs need to have something to do. Having a human companion, having a buddy at the dog daycare is huge and very helpful. And sometimes it could be an interspecies relationship. Besides a human and dog, could be a cat that they live with and hang out with.
Well, that's interesting. So I actually understand, Allison, that you can dispel some favorite dog myths, one maybe being the relationship between dog and cats.
I'm not exactly sure what that myth is at this point, but, not all dogs like cats.
Correct.
and not all dogs don't like cats. So you really need to check out the scenario and check out the dog. If you've got a cat, one of the things though is I definitely, if your cat's old, don't get it a dog.
My dog lives with three cats. I think she's more cat than dog, actually.
Yeah. My childhood dog loved cats. I haven't had one since.
Well, what about any other favorite dog myths that are worth dispelling on the air?
When their nose is hot and dry, they must be sick.
That's good.
And if it's cold and wet, they must be well. Mm-hmm. That's a myth.
What else?
Let's see. My little dog thinks he's a big dog because he barks and lunges at things. That is actually exactly the opposite. Your little dog thinks he's a little dog, and he's terrified and trying to make things go away so he doesn't have to deal with them.
Now, what about humping means?
Humping means nothing. Humping is... in the daycare, we define it as a social anxiety behavior. It definitely is a combination of arousal and social awkwardness. Really confident, well-socialized dogs do not do it. And there are a lot of dogs who hump because they're all excited to be there. And, oh, God, I need to. And then they do that. And then they get corrected, and then they become more socially awkward, and it just goes on and on.
And we're talking about neuter dogs. If your dog has testicles and it's humping, it probably means... He's Randy.
Okay. Yeah.
What about excited? Does excited mean happy?
Excited does not mean happy. Excited is excited. Aroused.
Oh, okay.
Yes, worked up.
Sometimes I could be nervous. I mean, if you think about people as well.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, right before the show, I was pacing and carrying on, and I was aroused, but I wasn't necessarily
right.
happy.
Yeah,
so,
exactly.
You know, just a lot of times you can anthropomorphize, and you can sort of take that and apply it to yourself. Not always, but there are some very strong similarities in our behavior.
I do find people are attached to excited behavior, thinking that their dogs are really happy because they're bouncing around a lot and jumping up and carrying on. It's not necessarily happy.
What about with... There's this whole thing with the off-leash at the Golden Gate Recreation Area. Where do we stand now with that? I know that's kind of a hot topic here in San Francisco.
It is. What we know is, as Allison said earlier, that, you know, one of the fundamental things that dogs need is exercise. And as a veterinarian, when I would have clients come in with some behavior problems and anxiety, any anxiety-based problem, the number one thing before we got to medication and any other thing was go exercise. And it's true of people as well. A tired dog is a happy dog. And we need open spaces. Dog walks on leash are great, but there are times when you just need to romp and play. And so for years, since 1972, pet owners, dog owners have had access to about 1% of GGNRA lands for open space. And that's now under review. And so we're
And just to just for listeners that aren't familiar with what 1% feels like here in the city, what is that currently? What
so there's 80,000 acres of GGNRA land. So what is that, 8,000 or something like that? You know, so it's a huge amount of land that's available for all of us to use. So we're hoping that we can strike a nice balance between allowing access, because it's not just about dogs. And I want to get back to that. It's not about dogs against people. It's about people with their dogs wanting access. And when people are out there with their dogs, they're enjoying the nature, and they're becoming environmentalists, and they're becoming some of your best activists to save these areas. And so, you know, we have to be mindful of the rules again, and making sure that we're picking up after ourselves, that we have dogs that have good recall, and that we're not being a burden. But it is space for all of us, and dog owners just want to have access to some of that space.
Okay, Allison, is there anything you wanted to add to that?
No, I just, you know, the East Bay has amazing resources and very little conflict as of yet, and that's been great. And I know San Francisco's really struggling to maintain its off-leash areas, and it is really, really important. It's an important resource for everybody.
Well, one I know that one complaint is that, you know, that off-leash play can increase incidence of aggression. And is that true?
No. That's not true.
No.
In fact, I challenge you to go down to Fort Funston on Sunday morning about 10 o'clock, and you'll see hundreds of dogs interacting. And that's the thing, is when dogs are pent up and they don't have exercise, and they're meeting nose-to-nose, leash-to-leash, that's where we see most of our outbursts.
Right.
When they're out there romping and having a good time, we rarely, rarely ever see
it. So when dogs are off-leash and they can control distance and they can pick and choose their playmates, it's much easier for them to get along.
Okay, well, this has been fantastic. Let me just let you each have just maybe a couple sentences just to tell us any upcoming events at your respective facilities. Allison, why don't we start with you?
Sure. I'll put in a plug for our puppy socials, which are free every Sunday morning for puppies under 20 weeks of age. And so come on down, see our place, and get to know us. And we have really good coffee, too.
Fantastic. And Scarlett, what about you?
If you're concerned about off-leash areas, there are two things that you might want to put on your calendar if you're a dog guardian or you're concerned about this issue. The first is Saturday, October 1st. Dog Pack is sponsoring a discussion with the mayoral candidates. And then you can go to their website. And then October 6th is a review about off-leash areas in San Francisco. So go to the Parks and Rec site to find out more about that.
Well, thank you. Thank you so much. That's City Visions for this evening. Our guests tonight were Dr. Jennifer Scarlett, veterinarian and co-president of the San Francisco SPCA, and Allison Smith, co-owner and director of behavior at Metro Dog. Thank you both very much for being on our show.
Thank you so much.
For a link to this and other City Vision shows, to let us know what you thought about tonight's program and to subscribe to alerts and download podcasts, check out our website at www.cityvisionsradio.com. Our engineer this evening was Kevin Vance. Thank you so much, Kevin. Our tonight's producer was Lisa Denenberg. Thank you so much, Lisa. Great job. City Vision's founder is Rose Levinson. Our senior producer is Judith Sanson. Our other contributing producer is Susie Britton. Neil Fries manages our website. Join City Visions next week as we discuss the challenges middle-income earners continue to face in affording housing in San Francisco. This is Lauren Meltzer. Thanks for listening. Good night and have a great week.